This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
From the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Ho-Ho Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia. Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanboys.
Place to be nation pop! We are living the high life, as only we can do, right here in the L-shaped studios. I am Greg Phillips, with me as always, in life and in podcasts. Is Nick Duke. We are the hard traveling fanboys. We would like to welcome you into Ho-Ho Loon Plaza in Skookum. How are you doing today, good sir?
I'm doing okay. I'm having to adjust to this new world order, you know, what with, I don't know that people know this, Greg, but you were actually recently named the constable of Ho-Ho Loon Plaza, so I'm having to readjust to the way things are done around here. It's been a bit of a shock to the system, but I'm getting used to it, and safe to say that you are already drunk off your own power.
Absolutely, and I have to admit, Nick, I'm not even sure what my power entails. Some weeks I seem to have more power than I have in other weeks, mm-hmm. but I am the constable, and that's one thing that I'm going to remind our listeners of constantly throughout the show.
Yes, and we will see how that goes, of course. Next thing you know, you'll be wearing vests and shaving your head, which I've been advocating for the head part for some time now.
And the vest part, oddly enough. But, that being said, we are here, gathered here today, to get through this thing called life. And to do that, we are going to watch a superhero suffer for our sins. And in this case, this is actually a listener-requested show, mm-hmm. Nick.
Yes, it
is. Our longtime, dear, close, personal friend on Twitter, Mr. Mike.
And what's his Twitter handle, Greg?
What's his Twitter handle?
Yeah.
What is this, the Inquisition?
I'm just asking what his Twitter handle is. I mean, he did reach out to us with this feedback on Twitter. I think people would want to know his Twitter handle so that if they want to talk a little Daredevil, Devil in Cell Block D, they would know, of course, to go to @FrankFran29.
29, right.
Some of us, Greg, appreciate our listeners and know their Twitter handles. Some of us, however, only pay lip service to appreciating our listeners, and I will leave it up to our fine, intelligent listenership to determine which is which.
Oh, it's easy for you to say that now. Mm-hmm. But when Chandler Riggs joins the cast of The Flash,
oh, for God's sake.
Then which listener are you going to be appreciating at that point?
What does Chandler Riggs have to do with our listeners?
Well, I'm just saying one of our listeners seems to be advocating for that possibility.
And let me just state, while I think Chandler Riggs is no great shakes as an actor and probably deserves to go to the seventh level of hell known as Auburn University, my beef with him was mostly with his character, not with him as a person.
No.
But we're veering wildly off topic already.
You took one look at that haircut and you made up your mind.
Well,
you chose your side.
I ain't for it.
Anyway, yes, our good friend Mike suggested
we don't let our hair grow long and shaggy like the hippies out in San Francisco do.
And I heard that you don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee.
No, we don't. Muskogee County, actually. Hey, that's a real thing. Good call, Greg. I work in Muskogee County, so it fits.
Well, regardless of Muskogees, Okies, or Stogies, we are not here to talk about any of that.
Nope.
We are here to talk about
Blue Chew. We're here to talk about Blue Chew. Have you heard about Blue Chew?
Yes, at the behest of our listener, Mike.
Well, now, I don't want to cast any aspersions on Mike's character.
We are here to talk about Blue Chew. Tell the people about Blue Chew, our new sponsor, Nick.
Well, let me tell you something about Blue Chew. Blue Chew are these nice little gummies, and they're blue. And, you know, you think about what else in the pharmaceutical industry is blue. And I think there's a little pill that comes to mind. All I'm saying is you grab you a couple of these Blue Chews, you pop them in, you chew them up, and, you know, you go up to your favorite gal or man and just, you know, see what pops up.
He's talking about a penis.
Blue Chew. Fantastic.
Yes, and we'd like to thank Blue Chew, mm-hmm. as would all of our listeners out there, mm-hmm. For joining on board with us. And while, yes, you would think that to have a sponsorship would entail some sort of exchange of money at some mm-hmm. point, mm-hmm. in this case, it's a sponsor in name only.
Yeah. I mean, they don't need to give me money, Greg. They have already given me the mental image of 60-year-old Eric Bischoff's sex life, which is more, which is worth more than any monetary amount.
Listen, that reminds me, Nick. Talking about 60-year-old Eric Bischoff's sex life may sound off-putting, but I would like to just go ahead and apologize for how we ended the show last week with perhaps the most off-putting mental imagery of all time.
What's off-putting about Conway Twitty trying to get his, you know, trying to get his work in, trying to get it, lay his shit in, kid?
You know, I guess to each their own. It's just
Conway Twitty was an attractive young man.
Conway Twitty had hair that will last the span of time.
He did have a lot of short and curlies.
But you know what's not short and curly?
That transition, it's short, but I don't know that it's curly.
Daredevil's hair. Artist Michael Lark, mm-hmm. who listeners, longtime listeners of the show, might remember from our review of Gotham Central.
Way back in the column days, yes, yes, yes.
Yes.
And you know what's interesting about this is, especially when you compare it to the modern, you know, typically nowadays when there's a big creative shift or a new creative team coming on, titles will almost get something of a fresh start, especially if it's moving from one name creator to another big name creator, as Daredevil did with Brian Michael Bendis, they had Brubaker. But Brubaker, rather than kind of resetting the table, picks up the pieces that Bendis left behind and just like escalates them even further. So I thought it was very interesting to see a run beginning right where the last one left off. And yes, that may sound simplistic and it may sound like something that comics naturally do anyway, but if you read this, you really understand that it is not attempting to be a fresh jumping on point. In my view anyway.
No, I don't think. I think you could pick it up in that. We did talk about this going into it. Yeah, neither one of us, including Bendis fanboy Nick Duke, neither of us have actually read Brian Michael Bendis's Daredevil run.
I've read some snippets. Now, honestly, primarily they're the issues that had Jessica Jones pop up as a guest star, because I wanted to read the complete Jessica Jones story at one point. But, you know, like you said, I am a big Bendis fan, and I'm a fan of what I've read, but I have never sat down and read the entire thing, which is something that's on my to-do list, honestly, because I've heard nothing but good things. And judging by what I have read and knowing my sensibilities, I'm fairly sure I would love it.
Yes, our friend Tim Capel, friend of the show, often says that Daredevil is never not good. So, you know, that throughout the character's history, he tends to attract strong creators and strong creative teams.
Sorry, not to get off on another tangent here, but when that conversation came up in the legendary and exclusive Place to Be Nation Comics private Facebook chat, I just wanted to say that you know the manager Todd Weber tried to throw a little shade at the Ultimate Universe and said it was Ultimate Daredevil. And so, out of curiosity, I went and looked that up. Do you know who the writer was of Ultimate Daredevil?
I have no idea.
Greg Rucka.
It may have sucked, though.
With art from Salvador La Roca. I reread the first issue. It's great. Shut up, Todd.
Be careful, Todd. You don't want to insult the Ultimate Universe around Nick.
Insult the Ultimate Universe for things that are actually bad. Don't take shots at things that aren't. Talk about Ultimatum. Talk about Jeff Loeb. Talk about the entire, like, post-2009 universe.
Or Ultimate X-Men.
Ultimate X-Men is fine. You people have, you know, it's not great, but it's fine.
Regardless, we're not here to talk about the Ultimate Universe.
Why not, damn it?
We're here to talk about the far superior mainstream Daredevil. So
you've never read Ultimate Daredevil.
I don't need to read Ultimate Daredevil because I know the original is king.
You know that. You know a lot of things, apparently.
All I know is, to your point, Nick, getting us back on track, the jumping on point aspect. Daredevil, actually going way back to the Frank Miller days, seems to have that sort of yes, it's a you can pick it up and understand what's going on based on context clues, but it really builds and builds and builds off of what happened back in those days.
Yeah, and that's true, and I think that's something that we saw even when we did our review of Kevin Smith's Daredevil,
yep.
because that was definitely layered with continuity. I mean, you needed something of an understanding of Daredevil's past and even like the larger Marvel Universe's past to really be able to get the full context of that story. So that's a great point.
I think that it's just it's almost a throwback in a way to how comics kind of were done in the past at times, where you know you could pick it up and you could understand it if you had never read anything, but you'd get a greater context if you had the built-in understanding of continuity.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think people have decided largely that it's just easier to not do that. So,
and could it also be part of the – I mean, like Tim says, Daredevil is never not
right.
good. So could part of it be there haven't been that many needs for big resets or revamps
right.
of the character over time? I think that could also play into it.
Yeah, and there's a good point to that. And so despite all of these years of greatness on the character of Daredevil, both Nick and I have – relatively limited exposure to Daredevil. Nick, I think, has read more than me overall due to reading some of the classic Daredevil, which you can hear on the Marvel Age podcast.
Well, in addition to the stuff I've reread for Marvel Age, after the first season of Daredevil came out on the Netflix, the Netflix show, I actually went back and kind of got into a Daredevil kick, and I think I read something like the first six or so years of the Daredevil solo series. So I think I read like maybe six or seven issues after Stan Lee left the book. So I got that far into the character history. So weird that I've gone back and looked at the Silver Age stuff, but not the more critically acclaimed. Never read any of the Frank Miller stuff. Never read any of the Bill Sienkiewicz Elektra stuff. Like, never read any of those.
And the Cine on Daredevil. Never read. We read a little bit of the Kevin Smith.
Actually,
the only Kevin Smith volume.
Actually,
right?
I do own one issue of Ann Nesenti's Daredevil. And it doesn't even really count, but my uncle gave it to me, or my great uncle gave it to me on a trip to North Carolina when I was a kid, and it was a special edition of Daredevil they had published to warn about the dangers of noxious fumes and to encourage kids to like not be in rooms with like gasoline and paint thinner and stuff as Daredevil was battling like Mr. Noxious or whatever the cheesy villain's name was. And apparently it was actually written by Ann Nesenti.
So basically, it was actually written by the Human Torch in disguise. Since asbestos is his greatest enemy.
What does asbestos have anything to do with this?
Well, you see, I have no idea. I was only halfway listening to what you're saying. It's just typical for our show. Carry on.
Bruce Pritchard.
Oh, boy. So, yes, and I have read, picking up from where Nick said, Nick's read the one issue of Ann Nesenti. I have read the two volumes now, after this one, of Ed Brubaker's Daredevil, because we read a volume back in the column days that we reviewed.
Hell to Pay.
Hell to Pay, which is kind of in the middle of his run. And I have read the first...
Had the Gladiator in it, right? Or not the Gladiator. Well, yeah,
yes,
the Gladiator. Yeah,
yeah. Gladiator. Melvin Potter.
Melvin, yep.
And I have read the first two volumes, I think, of the Mark Waid Daredevil reboot a few years ago.
Which I've heard is very different than most post-Frank Miller Daredevil stories.
Yes, it is much different from what we're reading in this one. But it's still very good.
Mm-hmm.
Just a different style.
Mm-hmm.
But point being, we're not Daredevil experts by any means, so we were kind of going into this a little bit blind on a little bit blind in terms of our knowledge of the character and our knowledge of his current events at the time of this story arc, which I believe, and Nick, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it took place in 2006, which was right around the time of Marvel's Civil War event, correct?
Yes. This would have been right before Civil War, and I think it actually probably, because it's six issues, I think it extended into the opening salvo of Civil War as well. And, events that were in this book would be directly referenced in various Civil War tie-ins later on. So this is very much right here in that Civil War time frame.
Yes. So I think, you know, we usually like to give a little bit of background on the creators of the books that we're talking about. But I think that everybody that's listened to our show pretty well knows about Ed Brubaker by this point. Mm-hmm. If you don't, crash course. Extremely well-known writer, most associated at this point with Captain America, I think, because he had a multi-year run on that character, is responsible for creating, essentially, the Winter Soldier mm-hmm. when he brought Bucky Barnes back from the dead and reinvented him as the Winter Soldier. Pretty much a lot of the great ideas in the Captain America movies came from the mind of Brubaker in his run on the comics. Mm-hmm. Also known for extended run on Batman, mm-hmm. Gotham Central, which we've reviewed here on the show, mm-hmm. and just a cavalcade of creator-owned books that, to me, are the best books on the stands usually. So he's an established, excellent writer. Michael Lark, we talked about known to us primarily for Gotham Central, which is just exceptional. If you haven't ever read Gotham Central, seek it out. I think you can find it now recollected by DC Comics mm-hmm. in nice new trade paperbacks.
I think they actually have an omnibus as well. So
I think you're right, yeah. So I would highly recommend reading that. It's I haven't read all of it, but what I've read of it is excellent.
Yes.
So these guys both have a reputation going in, and they're inheriting –
especially for these types of stories that are, you know, typically told in the pages of Daredevil.
Yeah, so let's talk about that for a moment. Daredevil is a character that I think at times has been kind of called Marvel's version of Batman, basically.
Yeah.
Because I think perhaps with the ties to Frank Miller.
Yeah, I think I just think in terms of the structure of the stories they typically tell with him, he's the closest to Batman. Yes, you have the fantastical abilities side of it that kind of is different, but in terms of telling street-level, crime-focused stories – I think that's a pretty accurate assessment. It makes it all the more surprising that you and I have not read much Daredevil, given our love of Batman stories.
Exactly. And so there is an element of that. And so Brubaker and Lark specialize in these kind of pulpy stories. Pulpy stories that would feel at home in the 1940s that, you know, have a certain level of grit and violence to them that are not what you would associate with the, quote, grim and gritty 90s in terms of everything being extreme, but really everything being subtle mm-hmm. but more emotionally violent, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Brubaker in particular loves to put his characters through the ringer, and that's exactly what we find here in The Devil in Cell Block D.
Absolutely. You know, it was something that I was not – I mean, I knew it was going to be Brubaker, so I knew it was going to have a darker edge to it, but I was not expecting – the places they were going to take Matt Murdock in this. It's a genuinely shocking book, and I'm not sure, I mean, it's over 10 years old at this point, so I don't know that we need to really, what's our policy going to be on specific plot points here?
Well, I mean, I would go with whatever you go with on that.
It's kind of hard.
I don't want us to become a plot recitation, basically. No. That's what I don't want it to be. So,
yes, I would agree with that. I just think it's very interesting that they open this story with a bang. You want to take Matt Murdock to a place he's never been before, and there's one mm-hmm. quick and easy way to do that. He's lost love interest, he's lost family, but he's never lost Foggy Nelson. And issue one ends with the death of Foggy Nelson, which is... caught me by utter and complete shock, even though it was 10 years old. I had somehow not had that spoiled for me.
Yeah, same here, Nick. I was completely caught off guard by that. And also, in addition to that happening in issue one, we should probably mention this: the basic premise of The Devil in Cell Block D, as you might be able to work out from the title, is at the end of Bendis's run on the character, after taking down the Kingpin and putting him in prison, Daredevil's identity is made public, and the FBI arrests Matt Murdock and charges him with a litany of crimes mm-hmm. related to being Daredevil. And so when we pick this up, Matt Murdock is in prison, still denying that he's Daredevil, mm-hmm. but basically the entire world thinks that he's Daredevil, and the government is out to prove it.
Yes, and not even necessarily out to prove it, but clearly there are those in the FBI. Part of the plot of the story is they are delaying his trial intentionally. They are trying to set him up, basically, to take the fall in jail before he ever makes it to a court of law, because they know right. that Matt Murdock, being who he is, would probably, you know, would probably hand the FBI its ass in federal court, so...
And he is stuck in prison with all these people that he has helped imprison, essentially. Mm-hmm. All these people with reasons and motivations to want him dead, mm-hmm. to want him to suffer as well.
Characters like Hammerhead, the Owl.
Yes.
Various others. Melvin Wilson, Potter, as we referred to before.
Yes.
The Kingpin, as we said.
Wilson Fisk, the Kingpin, yes. Mm-hmm. And even an unexpected guest that joins later on in the story. And I want to talk for just a moment, Nick, while we're talking about the story. I want to talk about the character of Hammerhead. How great is Hammerhead?
I heard you're snickering. I feel like you have some sort of Hammerhead fascination that I'm not aware of.
I do. I have, since I was a small child, Nick, I've been fascinated by the character Hammerhead.
Okay.
The one thing that I've never been able to figure out, maybe you can help me with this.
Okay.
I've never been able to figure out, I mean, he seems like a powerful gangster, you know? Mm-hmm. He seems like he's got some level of influence in New York City, mm-hmm. which is an influential city in the Marvel Universe. Mm-hmm. What I've never been able to figure out, why the hell do they call him Hammerhead?
Why do they call him Hammerhead?
Yeah.
Because his head, in addition to being very large and misshapen, is like literally as hard. It's very hard. He can headbutt things. Like he can headbutt like through walls. And if you try to punch him in the head, it's basically non effective because he has a Rocky Balboa in Rocky III like level chin on him. Now, granted, I'm assuming there's a lot of CTE involved in that as well, but that's why he's called Hammerhead.
I'm so disappointed in you, Nick. Taking a guy's physical appearance and physical malady,
uh-huh.
and making a nickname of it and joining in that with society. I mean, have we ever asked him if he wants to be called Hammerhead? Feels to me like it's a little insulting.
Well, no, he's a fictional character, so I've never asked him.
Have you known of any characters in Marvel Universe to ask him?
I'm sure Spider-Man has probably asked him how he feels about the nickname at some point or another.
Well... I'm just saying, to me, it's insulting. I would be offended if I were him. And I think they should just call him by whatever his real name is. Nick, what's his real name?
I don't know.
It's Gerald Hammerhead. So let's move on.
What the hell are we doing here today?
Let's move on and stop talking about Hammerhead and talk more about what Brubaker and Laurie could do with this story. So the entire thing... from Matt Murdock's perspective, takes place in prison. Mm-hmm. Matt is locked away for the entire duration of this story.
Well, not the entire story.
Until the end.
Until the entire last issue, he's out.
Right, right. But, yeah, the entire last issue, he is out in... But he's not out, if that makes sense. He's still technically a...
He's fugitive. He's a fugitive of the law.
Fugitive of justice, yes. So... But the bulk of this story takes place with him in prison. But there are things that happen outside the prison, things that include the various side characters. You get Foggy in the first issue. Of course, he's taken off the board very quickly, as we mentioned, in extremely shocking fashion. One of the great scenes in the entire story, I thought, was that harrowing scene at the jail. The funeral scene that follows it in issue 2 and Matt's quest for revenge. I don't know about you, Nick, but I thought it was gripping stuff.
Yeah.
Of watching Matt pushed over the edge to a point where he's going to become exactly what his father never wanted him to become.
Yeah, it was gripping. Even as someone who, like we've said, we don't have a ton of knowledge of Daredevil's publishing history, but it felt important, and it felt like this character transformation in Matt was earned. It felt like the culmination of a lot of threads that had been building to this point, and that's what makes it all the more remarkable that it's Brubaker's first story arc with the character. He is picking up all these years of build and taking it to this very natural extension. And I have to say, as we're exploring that idea of Matt becoming unhinged, I thought this was one of the best uses of Frank Castle as a supporting character in a story that I have ever seen.
100%.
It was unexpected. I did not see where it was going when he was first introduced, and yet it was perfect. I mean, pitch fucking perfect.
I agree completely. Frank Castle, the Punisher, is used in this story in a way that both reaffirms his status as Marvel's biggest anti-hero,
mm-hmm.
and also manages to focus a little more on the last part of that word, which is hero.
Yes.
And it's an element of the Punisher that I think gets lost sometimes in that what is it that keeps him from being an outright villain? There isn't much. But I think what it is that there is enough heart in there to salvage.
Right.
And I think that's executed perfectly here.
Yes. Try as he might, he is not capable of completely severing all his emotional ties with humanity. Like, that is not who he is, and that shines through here in a limited but crucial role.
And along the way, we also have another subplot that goes throughout the entire story until the last issue. And that is that while Matt is locked up, there is someone else masquerading in New York City as Daredevil with the intention of casting doubt on everyone who is certain that Matt Murdock is Daredevil. So we see this other Daredevil who operates a little bit differently but is trying his best to mimic the real Daredevil as he is taking out criminals, leaving call signs behind, making sure to be seen at night in the efforts to clear Matt's name. We don't know who has hired him or who has asked him to do this. We just know that he's doing it. So there are a couple of mysteries there. Who is this guy? Who is behind his actions? We, of course, spent a lot of time with Ben Urich in this story as he is trying to uncover evidence to help clear Matt, to help figure out what's going on, the greater mystery. We also see a lot of Dakota North, who is a character, Nick, that I think we first encountered in our other Brubaker story that we reviewed, but it's been so long that I didn't really have any memory of her, and I don't know much about her character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't either. And if we did encounter her in the other Brubaker story, then it would have chronologically taken place after this one. So this is an introduction. I don't know who she is. I don't know much about her, but she served the story well. I did like that they actually had a line of dialogue to explain why she was the private investigator and not Jessica Jones, who had that previously established relationship with Matt Murdock. So,
yeah, what was the reason for that? I don't remember that.
Jessica had just given birth, and she and Luke were busy with the baby.
Makes sense.
Yep.
Apparently, Dakota North was created in Dakota North number 1 in 1986.
All right.
By Martha Thomas's and Tony Salmons. Interesting. I literally had no idea of this character. She's appeared in Web of Spider-Man, Power Pack, Black Panther, all kinds of comics. So apparently she's well-known in the Marvel Universe, just not to us. Mm-hmm. But she was really good here. I enjoyed her role as kind of the hard-nosed investigator who really takes it personally that Foggy Nelson is killed on her watch while she's there with him, and takes it upon herself to kind of, along with Ben Urich, unravel everything. We also get to see the return of one of perhaps Matt's greatest enemy, which is Bullseye.
Mm-hmm.
And I particularly enjoyed that issue as well, where the two of them finally came face to face. I thought they did a great job of building up Bullseye in a way that I really haven't – in the books that I've read in Marvel, I had never seen a Bullseye presented in such a, you know, if you break this glass, there's going to be a lot of hell to pay. Almost like a Hannibal Lecter type figure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was an interesting usage of him for sure. I dug the whole sequence where they're wheeling him into the prison and taking all the precautions and stuff. So that was really good. But you mentioned Ben Urich there, and I wanted to call special attention to all the Daily Bugle stuff here with Ben Urich and J. Jonah Jameson.
Mm-hmm.
Outstanding. Not, I can't say it's an ultra realistic representation of journalism, but it feels closer than most things we typically see, does it not?
It did. It did. You know, certainly J. Jonah is always a caricature,
right?
But it's a caricature that kind of works, mm-hmm. you know. And I really enjoyed their exchanges here, and I think that there were a lot of I definitely saw a lot of microcosms of reality there with the especially if you view Jonah as not just being the editor, but as being the publisher, perhaps, mm-hmm. of being a more corporate type figure, where he looks at it and he just wants to have the most sensational headline that will sell the most newspapers, right? And that will also fit whatever his agenda is. And Ben is the classic old school reporter who's trying to maintain objectivity to the degree that he sees all of Jonah's points about his own blindness towards this because he is close to Matt Murdock, but yet he still tries to maintain objectivity throughout the book until finally at the end he just throws caution to the wind. But yeah, I thought their exchanges here were much better than most comic book editor-reporter disputes that you'll see. Not all, but most. So yeah, I agree. I thought that was all good stuff.
Absolutely. So yeah, I mean, you got the basic plot of Matt there in prison, and basically what happens is because of Matt and Kingpin and Bullseye and all these major players being locked up in Rikers at the same time, tension grows inside the jail, and eventually it leads to a riot, a massive riot. Frank Castle as well, who we referenced earlier. And that's kind of the plot of it. I mean, you know, Matt has to figure out how to navigate the prison landscape, mm-hmm. has to deal with this riot, and then eventually has to go out and solve the mystery of the other Daredevil. So, pretty straightforward plot-wise, and it was very interesting because it definitely ends on a cliffhanger that makes you want to pick up and, you know, pick up and jump right to the next story arc with that last page reveal.
Yeah, 100%. I'll be honest with you, Nick. The only reason I didn't keep reading is because I knew we were doing this show, and I didn't want to get confused as to which plot elements happened where.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to just keep reading these Brubaker Daredevil issues. I was such a big fan of this. And yeah, it is a straightforward plot. It's basically what you and I are both kind of hoping to get out of Arrow this upcoming season,
yes,
I think, right?
Absolutely.
Which is the Brestular character locked away in prison and having to fend for himself in an environment where there's no help, there's no support system in place. It's just him against all of these demons of his own creation. And how does he navigate that? How does he survive that? How does he thrive within that? And how does he keep from giving in and becoming exactly like all these people that he's put here? And these are all questions that Matt Murdock wrestles with here in this book. That's what's most compelling to me about all of this. The mysteries are great. Mm-hmm. There's several great mysteries going on, but I think at the core of it, what makes it appealing is the tortured and fragile psyche of Matt Murdock, as every lesson that he's learned his entire life is put to the test now. His ethical lessons, his strategic lessons, his physical lessons. Everything is put to the test in this prison, and he's got to make so many different decisions in this book that are going to play out, I'm sure, for years to come, and try to keep himself from falling off the precipice. We also hear, we haven't talked about her because she's not in this book very much, but his love interest at this time mm-hmm. is a character named Mila.
Actually, his wife, I believe. Didn't they say that at one point, that he was married?
Perhaps. I can't remember. I know they were married in the other Brubaker volume we have, but mm-hmm. they may be married here. I can't remember. So, yeah, I'm guessing this was a major development in the Bendis run. But yeah, she shows up here and tries to talk some sense into Matt, but he clearly is not in the mood to listen at that time. But I just thought it was interesting because when you think about the classic Matt Murdock love interest, you always think of Karen Page and Elektra. Mm-hmm. But this is one that I really haven't heard people talk about much.
Yeah, I haven't either. And, you know, I remember her character very briefly from Hell to Pay, but I don't remember much else other than that. And this book is so focused on all these other characters in Matt Murdock's world that she kind of doesn't get much of an opportunity to be exposed to anybody who isn't overly familiar with her. So I can't really comment on her too much as a character.
Well, I should hope not. She's Matt's wife.
Other than to say something of an incomplete grade for me as far as she's concerned.
Yes, interesting to see where all that develops in the future of this this Bent or Brubaker run, I should say. Mm-hmm. And also, we'll probably meet her if we ever go back and look at some of that Bendis Daredevil, which I'm sure we will in the future. Now, we haven't talked about the art at all. So, Michael Lark.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
What else are you really going to say? I mean, the guy did Gotham Central, which is one of the best like gritty crime books of all time. And he brings that sensibility right over to Daredevil, and he is a perfect fit for Daredevil's world. Reminded me very much, actually, of Michael Gatiss on Alias. Has a very similar look to his art that Gatiss does. So, big fan.
And his art reminded me a lot of you know, in its own way, different but similar, of Sean Phillips, who is Brubaker's most common collaborator on his indie books, his image books, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The facial expressions are dynamite in this. Lark doesn't draw the traditional style superheroes. He has his own unique style for how he draws them, and the colors play a big factor in that too. The colors are actually a huge part of making that whole thing work. And the colorist here is Frank Darmada, and his colors really help to make the entire book look like this gritty, grimy thing that we're reading. And I think that Lark, whether it's the facial expressions for Matt, whether it's these scenes of Ben Urich kind of like torturing himself over what to do and how to handle this and his battle between his journalistic ethics and his moral responsibility to his friend, these are just extremely well realized. And when it's time to get violent and it's time to get dirty, I thought it was one of the few times that I've seen the Kingpin rendered in such a compelling and utterly violent manner.
Yeah, I mean, I agree wholeheartedly with everything you just said. Like I said earlier, his style fit this book perfectly. From the tone of the more contemplative scenes to, like you said, the brutality of the action scene. So everything about this was great.
Now, if you're listening to this show, odds are you're used to mature rated content or immature rated content, if you will. But I will say this. This is not the not necessarily a book you'd want to hand a young child first getting started into comics.
No.
Because there's a lot of language here. There's a lot of – and it's edited out, but you can easily see what they're supposed to be saying. And there's a lot of brutal violence here. So, you know, do keep that in mind. And you get to see Wilson Fisk's white alabaster keister.
Indeed you do.
And with all that said, I'm trying to think if there's anything else we've left out, Nick. I don't think so.
You know, we loved it. I mean, I don't know what else to say about it. It was outstanding. A fantastic suggestion from Mike, also known as FrankFran29 on Twitter.
Yep.
So yeah, thanks for the recommendation. We absolutely loved it, and two thumbs way up from me anyway.
Yeah, same here. I told Nick this a couple issues into it, but I stand by it after finishing it. For me, of all the Daredevil stories that I have read, this to me is the best.
Yes, I would agree with that.
This is a league above, and if the rest of Brubaker's run can even come close to matching this, he will establish himself as the early leader in the clubhouse for me of Daredevil writers.
Co-signed.
Well, there you have it. And if you disagree with us or if you'd like to chat with us about this, please go to the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Just go to Facebook, go to your search bar, type in Place to Be Nation Comics. Mm-hmm. We will let you in. We'd love to discuss this book with you, discuss this run with you. If you're a big Daredevil fan, what are your favorite runs on the character? What are your stories you'd like us to review in the future? Let us know, and let us know where the Devil in Cell Block D fits in your pantheon alongside some of the classic Daredevil stories, whether it's Born to Run or the Mark Waid run or other things. So we're always interested in conversating there.
Was Born to Run actually a Daredevil story?
You're probably born again, damn it. Son of a bitch. Born to Run is a Bruce Springsteen album.
It is.
It came out in the 1970s.
It did?
And it's pretty good.
I wasn't sure if there was a Born to Run Daredevil story that I was not aware of.
We're making the sausage right now. I'm gonna Google Daredevil Born to Run and see what we have.
Even if there is one, I think you lucked into it more than intended to.
Nothing's coming up on Google. Just Born Again by Frank Miller and David Mazzucchelli. So, but if you'd like to read this book and go to Place to Be Nation Comics and listen to Bruce Springsteen's seminal album, Born to Run, please feel free. Tramps like us, baby, we were born to run. And that I can't think of no better way than to pitch to the commercial break.
God, you know what we ought to get, Greg, is a clip of my uncle singing Born to Run.
Oh, my God. Folks, you...
you haven't lived.
You haven't lived until you've heard Nick's uncle sing Born to Run.
Note to self. I don't want to live.
we also can be found on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. God, what else? Oh, yeah, we have email addresses. GregP@placetobenation.com, NickD@placetobenation.com. They are the loneliest email addresses on the internet, folks.
We say that, but when's the last time we actually checked them?
I checked mine 2 days ago, actually.
Oh, well, good for you.
I checked
mine 2 days ago. Look at me.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me as well. If you really have any issues with the show, we invite you to tweet our other account at
JRsBBQ. Yes.
On Twitter. Yep. We invite your criticism of our show there. And the other thing we need to mention is that you are listening to the longest running
weekly
episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
That was a good one.
And we will be right back after these messages for all the wonderful shows here at Place to Be Nation and Place to Be Nation Pop, including Geek and Sassy, Sellers Points, Sunday Groove, / Easy Like David Sunday, Marvel Age Masterclass, Glenn Butler Podcast Hour, Spectacular, NBA Team. Gosh, I don't want to leave anybody out here, Nick. What am I missing?
Nothing.
Talking Pop.
Oh, yep. Talking Pop. All right, now a break.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Back, everyone. Welcome back to the studio.
Oh,
I'm Greg. He's Nick. You know the deal.
We are.
So, what do you want to do first this week, Nick? You want to hit up reading from the run now?
Yeah.
Well, here it is, folks. Let's do the jingle.
Welcome to the rundown.
So starting things out, we have Clarice Starling herself.
Oh, God.
We have Jodie Foster.
All right, we got to tell them, because we're just sitting here laughing into the microphone.
We won't get into the details, but we have... In between the commercial break, we have reenacted a certain memorable scene from the Silence of the Lambs with Sex Ferguson as Hannibal Lecter and Hall of Fame wrestling announcer Jim Ross as Clarice Starling of the FBI.
And all we'll say is that Bell's palsy was involved, and we'll just leave it at that.
My God.
Oh. Awful. But funny, because clearly we can't stop laughing.
Multiple Migs was also involved.
He was. I wonder if J.R. Starling drags the ground like J.J. Dillon.
Oh, J.J. Dillon. Good God. Oh. If they actually could have cast Silence of the Lambs using nothing but 80s and 90s wrestlers, because you could cast legendary WCW jobber Jumping Joey Maggs as multiple Migs.
You could. Sex Ferguson could also play multiple Migs. I think that would be interesting.
It would. Or you could take another wrestler and you could change the character's name to Multiple Riggs.
Multiple Scotty Riggs, yes. That would be good.
But let's talk about something that is also good, and that is Jodie Foster, legendary actress.
She alright.
Oscar winner, multiple time nominated. She is in talks with the FX network to star as Jennifer Brown, the mother of the main character in Why the Last Man, in a television series. This, of course, is the adaptation of Brian K. Vaughan and Pia Guerra's comic book series. Nick and I have reviewed it back in the column days, and it is outstanding, one of my favorite comic book series of all time. She would be playing the mother of Yorick Brown and also a U.S. representative, and she takes on something of a sinister role in the story. And I don't know about you, Nick, but when I saw this announced that she is in talks for this, I thought to myself, this just makes perfect sense. This is perfect casting.
Yeah, it's a really good piece of casting. And just further highlights FX's expanding role into the prestige TV format, where, you know, cable television is quickly becoming just as much of a destination for high-profile talent as the movies are. So hopefully this winds up happening, and hopefully they build a solid supporting cast around her and whoever is cast as Yorick. So very interested to see where this adaptation goes from here.
Absolutely, and I think in some cases the television world is doing better than the movie world, such as is the case with DC Comics. Mm-hmm. And speaking of DC Comics television, we have another high-profile actor rumored to be joining a DC property, and that is the upcoming Doom Patrol series on the DC Universe streaming service that, if you believe the scuttlebutt, will be dropping here in just a few months. Apparently, Kelsey Grammer is in talks to portray, and this is kind of ironic for fans of Frasier, Dr. Niles the Chief Calder. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Niles was his brother on Frasier, and Kelsey Grammer is yet to sign, but everything seems to be heading that way for him to play the Chief. This will be the second, I believe, DC live-action show on the streaming service after Titans. So I don't know how to view this as anything but a good thing. Kelsey Grammer is a damn fine actor, Nick.
Yeah, I don't know much about the Chief, but Kelsey Grammer is a good actor, so hopefully he will be able to bring something to that take.
I can only assume that the Chief is actually the nickname of Chief O'Hara, who is being brought into live action once more.
And strangely enough, I wonder if Chief O'Hara might have a role to play in future installments of Place to Be Nation Pop Comic Book Theater.
Oh, we'll have to leave that to chance. But one thing that's not being left to chance.
What would Chief O'Hara say if he were taking a woman in his arms to talk to her about the benefits of Blue Chew?
Well, he might say something along the lines of, you know, I've been having a lot of trouble getting it up lately. You're just not doing it for me anymore. But when I took me blue pill, suddenly you looked like Susan Sarandon, circa 1972.
I was about to say, God, are you looking for the opposite effect here?
You started to look like Margaret Thatcher naked on a cold day.
I love that your Chief O'Hara is like a step away from Grant Morrison. It's great.
My name is Chief O'Hara right now, but I'm going to fix the hole in forever. You'll see.
In any event.
So, let's move on, shall we?
We shall.
To an individual who is also in talks to join a high-profile Warner Brothers DC property in a TV capacity, and that is the confirmation now, actually, or from Deadline, that Jeremy Irons, or Irons as some call him, has been cast in an unspecified lead role in HBO's Watchmen. The Hollywood Trade describes Irons' unnamed character as, quote, an aging and imperious lord of a British manner, end quote. So, any theories on this, Nick?
Well, the most popular theory that's out there right now seems to be that he could be playing an older version of Adrian Veidt, or Vet, depending on your pronunciation.
Let's hope they go with Vet.
Let's hope we go with that. They go with that as well. Especially because, you know, this book is going to, or not the book, the television show is going to take place many years after the events of the original Watchmen, and yet not be a sequel or a continuation, and instead be some vaguely defined thing that Damon Lindelof is just making up terms for. But that's neither here nor there. This pisses me off because I don't want to be interested in this because fuck Damon Lindelof, and yet Jeremy Irons is a great damn actor and would be especially be a great damn aged Adrian Veidt, or Vet, depending on your pronunciation, that I find myself being forced to care about this against my will.
Same here, Nick. I was not wanting to be in any way invested in this project, and now I find myself getting more and more intrigued, and I have to admit, the continued quality of Doomsday Clock has assisted in this feeling. when is this series supposed to launch?
No clue. I do know that, if they're gearing up right now, I think HBO has a hole in their lineup for next year because typically they've been taking entire years off between seasons of Westworld, and so Westworld is not expected back until 2020 at the earliest. So it very easily could be a summer to fall 2019 show that kind of fills in that gap for Westworld.
Very good. So let's see. We'll have to see what old Damon Lindelof has planned for us.
Fuck him.
Well, one thing that Sony has planned is another spin-off movie of Spider-Man.
Allegedly.
Sony is developing a movie about Marvel's Silk. Now, for those Allegedly. Of you who I would assume would be most of you that don't know who Silk is, she is Cindy Moon, a Korean-American classmate of Peter Parker who is also bitten by a radioactive spider and develops similar abilities. Apparently, Cindy Moon appeared in Spider-Man Homecoming as a member of Peter's academic decathlon team, portrayed by Tiffany Espenson.
Nobody cares.
She reprised her role in a cameo in Infinity War. The Silk film is in development with producer Amy Pascal, who also produced Homecoming. Mm-hmm. Whether Espenson would reprise her role as Cindy Moon is unknown, as is whether the film would connect to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Your thoughts, Nick?
This will never happen.
Reasoning?
The same reasoning that Silver and Black isn't happening, the same reason we've heard nothing about the Morbius movie, the same reason that virtually every Spider-Man spinoff other than Venom is not happening. It's just not going to happen. There's not enough of a story there. Sony would be foolish at this point to risk the partnership with Marvel that they have going on, because the Marvel partnership is what stabilized Spider-Man on the big screen. It's what reestablished the character and redeemed it from the god-awful Amazing Spider-Man 2 that we talked about. I just don't see it happening. I think it's one of those things they are taking a flyer on for a script. They will realize there are issues with the script, and they will move on.
I think they need to give Mark Webb a chance.
And that's not to say anything disparaging about Cindy Moon or Silk as a character, because I haven't read any Cindy Moon or Silk. I just know, you know, Sony has a reputation for trying to force Spider-Man to be a cinematic universe unto itself and then realizing that it doesn't work that way. So I would be surprised if this happens.
I would not be surprised if we get a sequel to Spider-Man Homecoming, though.
Considering it's already been officially announced, yes, I would not be surprised either.
Exactly why I wouldn't be surprised by it. And I also wouldn't be surprised, Nick, if the title of that movie were to be Spider-Man Far From Home. Mm-hmm. This week, actor Tom Holland apparently, quote, accidentally, end quote, leaked the title of the Spider-Man sequel to be Spider-Man Far From Home. Mm-hmm. Now, two questions here. Mm-hmm. Do you buy that this is the actual title?
Yes.
And if so, what do you think this entails?
Well, we've already heard that it's going to entail a Peter on something of a trip away from his usual New York setting. the most heavily rumored thing is a European setting, kind of a European tour for Peter, perhaps as some sort of school trip or something like that. Then again, it could also entail, because other rumors would have you believe that the Spider-Man sequel picks up right at the end of Avengers 4, so Peter could very easily still be off in space or something. I mean, there's no telling what you're going to have there.
You know, obviously, faith in Marvel to pull it off, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
If I were fantasy booking, if it were going to be one of those two scenarios you laid out, I would be much more interested in Spider-Man in space, personally. But
yeah, but that doesn't really, like, fit in the story you're telling with this version of the character. You know, like, you just did the whole thing about him becoming a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man and forging this connection with the people of Earth, and to take it and go way out here, I don't know. I think it would be more
intriguing than taking him and putting him in, like, Europe or something, though, to me, anyway.
You see, and I want them to keep the high school setting, so if it's like a high school field trip, I'm down for it.
God dang, what high school is sending him on a field trip to Europe? I guess high schools that aren't in Alabama,
High schools that aren't in Alabama, high schools that are science-focused, high schools that probably have a Stark Foundation endowment.
An endowment, you say. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about Stark's endowment.
Well, you know, I wasn't that impressed by it. And then he started taking Blue Chew. And once he did that, yeah, I mean, just the endowment went through the roof.
Very interesting. And what's this product again, you say, Blue Chew?
Blue Chew, yep, Blue Chew.
Well, one thing that we forgot to get to last week, Nick, that we need to get to right now, is the biggest news in the print comics world, I would say, mm-hmm. which is that DC is reaching out to Walmart to put in 100-page Giants, which were a common staple of comics for many, many years. A lot of people grew up reading these, and they're like, they're going to be news stories as the lead, but then also repackaged old stories throughout these 100 pages, mm-hmm. and they're going to be centered on various characters.
Mm-hmm.
These are going to be coming to Walmarts everywhere, apparently, and I think each of these characters is going to have, you know, a different creator on it for the new stories. Bendis is a Batman story, which I know excites you.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting
Tom King is doing a Superman story.
Yes, Tom King doing a Superman story. Mm-hmm. So we're getting just a litany of creators here, and a litany of classic DC stories, such as Hush being reprinted here, at least one issue of it, I know that you were kind of not in the era of you didn't grow up in the era of comic books, you know, in stores, mainstream, basically. But I, for one, am, like, really stoked for this, because anything that gets more eyes on the product, anything that can help grow the industry is a good thing. And I think this is really, really awesome. I look forward to seeing these. And most importantly, I look forward to seeing how these sell. I think that's going to be really interesting to see.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So we'll see how it goes.
And that's it. That's all we have for the rundown.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is all we have for the rundown. So let's move on
to
reading
and
watching.
Very good. We should just keep finishing each other's sentences, Nick.
Oh, please, no.
Going every other word.
No.
So, what you been reading, Nick?
Nothing.
Nothing at all, eh?
Nope.
Well, I have been reading some. And if it's all right with you, Nick, I'd like to talk about the things that I've read right now.
Sure, why not?
The first thing that I've read in this time period that we're talking about, which is 1 week, is The Avengers, number one, Earth's mm-hmm. Mightiest Heroes, by Jason Aaron, Ed McGuinness, Mark Morales, and David Curiel. I forget. Have you already talked about this book on the show, Nick?
I have. Avengers number one, I have, yes.
Yes. So you kind of – people out there should probably know the premise of this, which is a brand new, yet another relaunch of the Avengers with a new yet another new lineup. This one being Thor, Captain America, Iron Man, the classics, Black Panther, mm-hmm. also quite familiar, Doctor Strange, mm-hmm. Captain Marvel, mm-hmm. Ghost Rider, mm-hmm. Robbie Reyes, mm-hmm. I believe is his name, right? Mm-hmm. And She-Hulk, who appears to be having, or the Savage Hulk, I guess you would call her at this point. She's having some issues controlling her rage. Apologies, Nick. I'm having a bit of a issue myself, apparently. Anyway, so it's setting up a new team of Avengers, but it's also introducing us to the Avengers, so to speak, of 1 million years ago, consisting of Odin, the original Black Panther, the original Ghost Rider, and a few other figures here, the Agamotto himself, of the famous Eye of Agamotto fame, and the Phoenix Force has inhabited a woman, or at least taken the form of a woman. Anyway... This is just a great story. I thought this was a great kickoff to things to come. It feels – I've told this to you, Nick, off the air, but it feels to me more like a classic DC story than a traditional Marvel story. And I'm not sure why that is. Perhaps it's the Ed McGuinness art, who had a great run on Superman Batman back in the day, the Public Enemy storyline. Perhaps it is the nature of the threat here, in that their villains are these massive celestial figures that almost look like the Anti-Monitor and feel it like this giant universe-threatening figure. I don't know what it is exactly, but it felt inviting to me in a way that an Avengers issue hasn't maybe ever. To be honest, Nick, I was thinking back on this, and all the Avengers comics that I've tried in my life, and there haven't been a ton, I'll admit that, but I've tried in the last 10 to 15 years, whether it was with Brian Michael Bendis' Avengers run, whether it was with Hickman's Avengers run, whether it was with Uncanny Avengers, with with any number of different times, I've given these books a shot, and none of them have hooked me, and for the most part, I have felt completely lost when I picked them up, unsure of character motivations, unsure of who everybody was, and maybe it's because of a little research ahead of this one, but I didn't have that problem here. I thought Jason Aaron dropped me right into the story. He reset these classic characters in a position that makes sense, and seems to be weaving a narrative that's going to tie together seemingly distant characters into one cohesive unit. I for one, thought the Avengers of 1 million years ago were phenomenal. I want more of them. So, yeah, I would have to say outstanding first issue of the Avengers. And I as much as I love Justice League number one, I think I liked Avengers number one just a little bit better, even though they were both great. So both Scott Snyder and Jason Aaron are kicking ass right now.
I agree wholeheartedly, even though I have not read Justice League yet. I'm going to read No Justice first. So, yeah, glad to hear you're enjoying it. Jason Aaron is an outstanding writer, and he has brought those sensibilities over to Avengers.
The other book that I read this past week is Nightwing versus Hush, number one, which is part two of Batman Prelude to the Wedding. These are a series of one-shots, I guess you would say, that actually, I say one-shots, it's more of a mini-series. Because they all have like loose connective tissue at the end that tie them to one another, lead into each other. Mm-hmm. This is the only one I bought. It's the only one that I'm going to buy, I think, because it involves two of my favorite characters. As you know, Nick, Nightwing is my favorite comic book character, and Hush is one of my favorite Batman villains and woefully underutilized. This book was written by Tim Seeley, who had a substantial run on Nightwing in the Rebirth Initiative, and it is drawn by Travis Moore, and Otto Schmidt does the epilogue. So this is the first time that I've really been exposed to Travis Moore's art that I can think of. And I thought the art was good throughout this. Maybe not great, but definitely good. There are some confusing issues with the action scenes. They don't really flow together the way that I would like necessarily. But it's a good issue. The art's good. The facial expressions are good. No complaints there. The issue as a whole, I thought, actually would have been better without Hush ever appearing. I thought everything involving Nightwing, Batman, and Superman, who is also in this issue, is great. Basically, the premise is Dick Grayson and Clark Kent decide to throw a bachelor party for Bruce Wayne, or Batman in this case. And that's a great premise, first of all. And second of all, the execution was outstanding when they were focusing on that aspect. Unfortunately, as well as Seeley Wright's Nightwing, and as compelling as his versions of Bruce and Clark are, I think that's how far off the reservation he gets when it comes to Hush. And we've talked about this before, Nick, many times in our days on the podcast, in the column, and especially in real life. Almost nobody has written Hush well. It's been Jeff Loeb and it's been Paul Dini, and that's been about it. And unfortunately, it doesn't really change here. I did not like – they take Hush in kind of a weird direction here. I don't know if you've read this, Nick. Have you?
No.
So one
I'm
of
not
the,
going to read this, so
yeah,
go ahead.
So I'll go ahead and let you know. One of the big surprise moves here in this issue is Hush reveals after he and Dick Grayson are trapped in his pocket dimension – that he has altered his face once again to, instead of look like Bruce Wayne, to look like Dick Grayson, because the Joker has made him realize that he doesn't actually want to be Bruce, that he actually just wants to return to the time in life when he was happiest, which is when he was Bruce Wayne's best friend, and thus he has attempted to take the face of Dick Grayson without knowing that he's Nightwing. It's a premise that doesn't sound that bad when you talk about it like that, but in execution I thought it was a lot worse, and I didn't like his dialogue. I didn't like his kind of generic rage that he had. I did like how Nightwing resolved the situation, but again, I can't really recommend this issue, unfortunately, because I thought the villain was so misused, mishandled. But I will say, I got to give credit to people that write Dick Grayson well. Seeley does here. I love his interaction with Bruce. But again, I don't know what it is, Nick. I wish we could find – if there was a character that I could reboot in DC right now, Hush would have to be on that list of characters for sure. They just need to do something to refresh him and get him back to the core of what made him compelling 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, you're right. Most writers really struggle writing Hush, so it's not really surprising to hear that Tim Seeley, who is very hit or miss, also struggles with the character. So I'm sorry you didn't enjoy it as much as you hoped you might.
Yeah, again, it wasn't a wasted investment entirely because I enjoyed aspects of it, but yeah, still ended up disappointing. But with that being said, that's the end of my reading list for this past week. I guess we should move on to watching. What you been watching, Nick?
The only thing I've been watching was the season finale of Supergirl, which was
mm-hmm.
okay.
Yeah.
It's kind of disappointing because the season had been so good to this point that I felt the finale was a little paint the numbers, but, you know, can't really complain too much, I guess.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Nick. I have an issue.
It was fine. Like, I don't...
Yeah, there were good things in it. There were really good things. The Mon-El stuff was... Mm-hmm. I feel like he's one of the best characters on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Jean and his dad, amazing. I thought the Kara and her mom stuff was good while it was there. I mean, it's really hard to complain about too much in terms of performance or things of that nature, but I will say that there hasn't been a recurring issue, and I'm going to talk about this about another show in a few minutes, but it's been a recurring issue I've noticed in superhero television in recent memory, and maybe you'll agree with me, maybe you won't. That is, I feel like when they get close to the end of some of these cases, they do two or three episodes in one episode, which was the finale. And to me, I think you can trace it back to that gun episode that we maligned, the very, quote, very special episode of Supergirl. If they had taken that subplot out and used it to flesh out some of this Argo City stuff, to me, they would have had a lot more real estate to work with in the last two episodes to space out the battle, to make it feel more conclusive, and to make the end of Rain feel a little bit more satisfying than I think it did, all things considered. And some of the stuff with the I thought the Legion just appearing out of nowhere didn't work for me. I would have liked to have seen that maybe take place in the prior episode and get a minute for it to breathe. And I don't know. It was okay. It was solid enough. It wasn't a bad episode by any means. But man, it was disappointing. Given that I thought the back half of this season of Supergirl was the best stretch of episodes they've had on that show.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I think part of the reason they do that, especially on network television, is to try and make it seem like the season finale is really impactful and has a lot going on. Mm-hmm. But they do that at the expense of the episodes that lead into it, I would argue. So,
Yeah,
it was a fine episode. I am a little annoyed by the tease for next season because I am just we've seen Kryptonian villain after Kryptonian villain after Kryptonian villain. Can we please do something else? Literally anything else?
Yes, enough Krypton at this point. Let's move on to Daxum.
For God's sake.
Actually, no, I agree with you. I'm so done with the damn Kryptonian invasion. And in fact, one of the things I think would be cool, we talked about last week, Kara against a speedster, or Kara against a magician, or Kara, just something that doesn't involve her having a big fist fight at the end of the season, you know, with somebody with similar powers, particularly given some of the show's issues with special effects this season. I love this stretch of episodes, but man, that finale just felt so packed in content that it left me feeling a little like it was a little bit rushed. But that being said, excited to see Brainiac 5 join the cast now. I thought he was a good addition to the show. And what would you like to see next season, Nick? Just gotten done with what I thought overall was a really, really good season. What would you like to see in Supergirl next year?
You know, the further exploration of Supergirl and Lena's budding rivalry, you know. I am interested in something of a villainous turn for Lena. I don't want them to go full Lex with it. They need to make it relatable and understandable. But I have far more interest in that than I do a split version of Supergirl or whatever the hell that tease was.
Yes, I've read that they're going to do a version of Red Sun next season, which I know what that entails in this context, but
that doesn't work without. Never mind. That doesn't work without the Cold War thing. Like, that's the only. Never. Just whatever. Fuck that.
We shall see. We shall see. And speaking of fornicating with things, I watched the last, as it turns out, four episodes of Luke Cage.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel of season one, I should specify. Mm-hmm. Have not started season two yet. While there was still some good stuff in there that I'll talk about in a minute, boy, oh boy, this was a challenge to get through for me these last few episodes. Because I should, and for people that are listening, I'm not just hating on Luke Cage, because Nick can testify to this. I thought the premiere episode of Luke Cage is one of the best episodes of Marvel television ever. It made my list of the top five. I thought the first half of the season was tremendous. The half of the season that focused on Cottonmouth. Now, the problem is the second half of Luke Cage focuses on Diamondback. And I had heard from Nick and from Russell and from others in our group that Diamondback was not a particularly satisfying villain. I'm not sure I fully expected what I got. Because in addition to being a not very interesting character and a trope of the Cain and Abel situation, which they, by the way, beat into the ground by literally quoting from Cain and Abel. Uh-huh. But when Diamondback finally confronts Luke Cage at the end of the season, he is sporting a costume on par with Vinnie Jones as the Juggernaut in X-Men 3 The Last Stand. Just a ludicrously bad, corny, cheesy-looking costume that in and of itself wouldn't necessarily be bad if you were doing a Power Man show based on the 70s version of Power Man. But this is a show that has grounded itself in reality in a universe, in the Marvel Netflix universe, that has prided itself on being grittier and more realistic than its television network television counterparts. And you're asking me to buy this. It wasn't good, is the Cliff Notes version there. Didn't like that. The glacial pace of this show. I mean, my goodness. The last four episodes moved like molasses. It felt like nothing was happening. They were going over the Mariah stuff ad nauseum with her back and forth with Diamondback and with Shades. It was just so much political maneuvering that they had already done in the first half of the season and kind of, again, gotten the point across. It's a corrupt city, and everybody's out for power. I get it. Then they get to the police. They beat that into the ground with the corrupt police. We'd already gotten it. Misty Knight goes through the same character arc like three times during the season. Mm-hmm. The one saving grace to me of the last several episodes of Luke Cage was Claire, played by Rosario Dawson. She is the linchpin of these episodes. She's the heart of these episodes, holding them together, along with Luke. But I thought she really stood out even more than Luke in these last few episodes. She was my rooting interest. She was the one where when she wasn't on screen, I was like, oh, what's going on with her? Is she all right? You know, and she was sort of the character that I gravitated to and that kept me invested in the episodes moving forward. And I got to say, man, I thought Luke Cage had such a great start that it's disappointing that it came to such an end.
Yeah, I had warned you about the steep decline of the show after the – it's not really a mid-season finale, but the show is kind of structured that way, even though it's Netflix, and that it's very much split up into what feels like two distinct chapters, and the first chapter is so much better than the second. I have not yet watched Luke Cage Season 2. I have not yet watched Jessica Jones Season 2, but I am hopeful that – the showrunners have learned their lessons from season one and can carry over the positive elements and minimize the negative ones.
Yes, I am.
And
I am,
now.
Oh, no.
And now the great news about this, ladies and gentlemen, is that now that Greg has finished Luke Cage, there's only one place for him to go from here. And that Greg is to Rand Industries, or whatever the fuck the name of the company is. And you, sir, are going to meet Danny Rand, the immortal Iron Fist and protector of Kun Lun. Who is, by the way, Danny Rand, the immortal Iron Fist and protector of Kun Lun.
The protector of what now?
Kun Lun.
Hmm. Wasn't sure. I thought I heard an extra letter in there somewhere. A T, perhaps, but nevertheless, I would much rather, instead of meeting Danny Rand, is it okay if I skip Iron Fist
No.
and instead watch No Holds Barred to meet Randy, the brother of Rip?
No. No.
Can I just skip to Defenders?
Nope. No. You have got to – you helped make this bed, and now you have to lie in it.
How did I help make this bed?
clamoring for it, begging for it. Oh, give us an Iron Fist show. Give us an Iron Fist show. Give us a martial arts show. Well, here's your version of a here's the Marvel Netflix version of a martial arts show. Enjoy, motherfucker.
Oh, give us a Jim Gordon show. Give us a show with Jim Gordon and Harvey Bullock as partners.
I sat through like 13 episodes of that. So now you got to do your 13 episodes of Iron Fist.
Here's the difference. As bad as those 13 episodes of Gotham were, at least they weren't incredibly slow and felt like 7 hours. That's the problem with Marvel Netflix. Everything takes forever. Let's
be fair though. Like that has worked in some instances. You know,
it's been a while.
It had.
At least for my
You haven't seen Punisher yet. Punisher is great. Like I think Punisher is.
I thought Daredevil season 2 was too drawn out. I thought
Daredevil Luke season Cage 2 was too drawn out. Daredevil season 2, like I think is, but I don't think it's too. I don't think it's as drawn out to the degree that Luke or Iron Fist are. Like it did.
No, it feels like it's getting worse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that I would agree with. But then Punisher is a huge course correction.
It's like they, and I've read this online, this is not an original thought, but it's like these producers think they have a 5 or 6 issue episode story, but they know they have 13 episodes. So instead of trying to come up with something interesting to fill, they just artificially stretch that 6 episode story.
Now, I will say that the Punisher definitely is stretched a bit. But the characters and performances and writing are just so damn compelling that it feels more like Daredevil season 1 or Jessica Jones season 1 in that regard.
And I'm looking forward to that for sure. Very much looking forward.
It's phenomenal.
The other thing that's interesting a point that I saw made online the other day is that the Netflix shows don't have the restrictions of network TV in terms of time limit. There's something to be said about having a time limit forcing you to edit yourself. And sometimes these episodes go on a little bit too long. You know, some episodes might be 65 minutes, some might be 48 minutes. And so there's a lot of fluctuation there. So
I can't wait for the wrestling minute, by the way.
All right, we're going
to
get there.
Sorry to interrupt. I just saw something and your reaction must be captured on these airwaves.
All right, very good. So anyway, that's Luke Cage. We'll be talking more about Marvel Netflix in the near future. The other thing that I've been watching is the best of all these things that I've been talking about to this point. And again, this is a show that, for all I know, could fall apart in the end as well. But I am six episodes in two. Krypton, or if you prefer, and you are from the Brando family, Krypton, on Sci-Fi Channel. I mentioned many episodes ago that I had watched the pilot episode and the follow-up, and so I picked it back up and watched 3, 4, 5, and 6 over the last few days. Utterly captivating, shockingly good. I can't say enough about this show, Nick. I have to be honest. Of the comic shows I've been watching in the last several weeks anyway, it's by far the best.
For something that you and I both had zero interest in coming in, like I said, I caught the pilot and thought it was outstanding, and I need to watch more. I know it's on my long list of stuff that I'm trying to catch up on, so I've heard nothing but good things from people who have seen it, so I am interested in doing that at some point.
And I think it's right up your alley, Nick, in that it's very much about the political machinations of Krypton, backdoor dealing, lots of characters with subtleties to them, to the point where I legitimately don't know where at least half the main characters on the show actually stand. Mm-hmm. Like, because they've done such a good job of planting seeds of doubt about all these different things, even down to the premise of the show being questionable in nature. It's all awesome. I can't say enough. I'm not going to spoil anything for you. Can't wait for you to check this out, because I hope you enjoy it as much as I am. It's been – it's been a revelation. I was not expecting this at all out of this show.
Okay. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it at some point.
And that being said, oh, and there's another thing. I watched another DC animated film.
Jesus Christ! What the hell have you been? Where did you get all this free time all of a sudden?
I didn't have. I actually had a weekend where I didn't have a thunder fucks like you taking up my time. So I got to sit down and watch a little DC animated action here. The DC movie called Justice League Dark, which I took a minute to remember the name of. This is about, of course, the Justice League Dark. And in this case, it's John Constantine, voiced by Matt Ryan of the television show and now of Legends of Tomorrow. And it takes place in the main DC animated continuity that they're doing with the New 52 versus these characters. So you've got Jason O'Mara as Batman. You've got whoever it is as Superman. Rosario Dawson as Wonder Woman, although she only appears very briefly. And Jon Stewart actually makes his first appearance in these movies, I believe. He pops up in this movie very briefly. But the main team is Constantine, Batman, Zatanna, Deadman, who is one of the best parts of the movie. And who am I missing? That's kind of the main. And Jason Blood, a.k.a. Etrigan the Demon. You also get appearance by Swamp Thing that feels a little shoehorned in, honestly. And Felix Faust, the classic Justice League villain. So this one was actually pretty good. You know, I've been somewhat critical of the DC animated slate in the last couple of years. I didn't think this was quite as good as Teen Titans Judas Contract or Justice League versus Teen Titans, but it was still pretty good. And I think the main thing that I enjoyed about it was, well, there are two things that I mostly enjoyed about it. Number one, I thought the humor worked a lot better than I expected because Batman is put in the Rorschach position from Doomsday Clock, if that makes sense, where he is reacting to these otherworldly, unbelievable things and can only muster up a most of the time. So that's been good. And then the action sequences in this movie are absolutely stunning, especially towards the end when they have their big battle near the end of the movie. Really great action scene. So overall, good movie. Would recommend checking it out. It's on Hulu right now if anybody wants to stream it. I enjoyed it. Not great, but solid.
Mm-hmm. You all right there?
Something is aggravating my vocal cords, and I don't know what it is. Something in the air or something. But every time I breathe, I feel like some sort of a tingling in my throat. And the last time I felt that was when I was first experimenting with Blue Chew.
I was about to say, you know, one way to clear out your throat would be to eat something, you know, slide something down there. And what better than a delicious and filling Blue Chew?
Blue Chew, absolutely. Well, Nick, we have wrapped up reading and watching, and I feel that this is one of the only times in the history of this segment that it's been almost all me talking instead of almost all you talking.
Mm-hmm.
So, gosh, what else?
Yeah, what else?
Before we get to anything else, what do the fans have? Yes, that's right. Our fans out there, the ones of you, what do they have coming their way, nigh on a week from now?
Dark Knight Month, as we kick off the month of July with a very special look back at Batman Begins, which I need to be scheduling that with our guest.
Indeed. One might say that our guest will be quite the experienced individual.
And, aww.
At managing.
We'll have to get his thoughts on Blue Chew.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know what's interesting? In the 1980s, think of how many managers there were in the World Wrestling Federation at a given time, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
And we have achieved this level of success because of only one.
That's true. That is very true. He is right up there with the Oliver Humperdincks of the world.
Sir Oliver Humperdinck, even. That's right. And Frenchie Martin. Don't forget him. Well, yes, Dark Knight Month. We'll look at all the movies. And with that being said, I can't help but notice, Nick, there's a minute on my clock that is actually built into the floor of my apartment. It's a digital clock, and there's a minute on it. That means it's time for the Wrestling Minute. What you got, Nick?
Outstanding. So much like reading and watching, we're just going to let you go here because I'm going to give you a statement, and then I'm going to let you react. On this week's SmackDown, which is actually airing as we record this podcast, the Big Red Machine Kane made his grand return.
Sweet God.
Grand return
hell.
To save Daniel Bryan, setting up a match between Team Hell No and the Bludgeon Brothers for the Extreme Rules pay-per-view. Your thoughts, sir?
This is the stupidest thing you've ever told me. And this covers so much ground, Nick, that I can't even begin to describe it to the people out there. But Kane ruins everything. Hashtag Kane ruins everything. I have no desire to watch Daniel Bryan's return be wasted on shitty tag matches alongside freaking Kane, where Bryan's going to have to work so hard. I don't like this at all, Nick. No, sir, I don't care for it. And that's been the Wrestling Minute. You need a damn chill pill.
Or a Blue Chew.
Oh, tell me more. Does Blue Chew have anti-heart attack qualities about it?
No, but it does redirect your blood flow to other areas of your body.
I like that. Areas including the spleen.
Mm-hmm. And the ear canal.
And I was there, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, with all that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we have reached the end of our long book hunt. We have reached the end of this week's episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Again, we invite you to join us for conversation. Mm-hmm. Send us your feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Let us know what we can do better. Let us know what we can do worse. We don't want to be too good. Not that we've ever been accused of that.
But we will now. We'll be accused of being too good, but with the Blue Chew and all.
That's true. That's absolutely true. And Chew. But Blue Chew can't be too good because Blue Chew is always necessary. Even if you think you don't need it, you do. Trust us.
Right.
And with that being said, we are going to take another week-long vacation. When we come back, we will be right here to talk to you all about Christopher Nolan and Batman Begins.
Hard traveling fanboys.